Okay, thank you. So what I thought I would do today is tell you a bit about hepatitis C, how it grows, infects cells, how we treat it, and focus really on the problem of drug resistance, which is what this meeting is about. And by way of introduction, by way of introductions, where I'll try and get to later in the talk is to try and explain data such as this. So these are longitudinal data taken from four HCV chronically infected patients who are treated in a phase one study with an HCV protease inhibitor, something called telaprevir. So you mentioned the HCV protease inhibitors already. What's being plotted here is on a log scale, the amount of virus measured in the blood. Each virus particle contains one HCV RNA, so if you measure the amount of RNA, you measure the amount of virus. What you can see is that under therapy is only given for 14 days. The time scale here is 14 days. The first time point is day two of the scale, and very well represented. But the purple is a wild-type virus, which means in terms of sequencing, they sequenced 60 clones. It's all done by Vertex, which is the company that makes this. They couldn't detect any drug-resistant virus at baseline. 2 days later, if you can see, say, in this patient, there's a dark red, the green bar, green bar, as I recall from this paper that this is taken from, which is down here, that these represented between 5 and 20% of the clones at day two. So by day two, resistance was already 5 to 20% of the viral population. And as you can see, by the end of the week, by day 14, close to 100% of the virus is detected with assays is resistant. And not only that, that the virus, the wild type virus, can fall 3 or 4 logs, and then the resistant virus can grow up by 3 logs also, all during that 2 week interval. And so there's a lot of very rapid dynamics occurring, and if I have the time, I hope to do it, I'll show you a trial with another protease inhibitor towards the end, a Merck protease inhibitor, where you can actually, my colleagues have done an enormous amount of sequencing. You can actually see the changes in the quasi-species with extraordinarily rapid turnover of subpopulations. Well, what's going on? What's HCV? For a little bit about it. The genome is about 9.6 KB. So it's a small virus that codes about 10 proteins, very much similar to HIV. It's a positive strand RNA virus, which means this genome is really a messenger RNA. So it's a messenger RNA packed in an envelope virus. When it infects, it has to be translated, makes its own polymerase, protease, a variety of enzymes that drive its replication cycle. It has an error-prone RNA polymerase, which it encodes. We've estimated the error rate, the substitution rate of it in vivo is very similar to that of HIV. Approximately 2.5 times 10 to the minus fifth is the error rate per base copied. The genome, for all practical purposes, is 10 KB. So it implies that there's about a 25% chance that a base will be miscopied every time a new virus is generated. The reason it's of concern is it causes cirrhosis and elevates the chances of getting liver cancer. And I'll show you what cirrhosis is in the next slide. And that people, it's now the leading cause of liver transplantation because both cirrhosis and end-stage liver disease can result from this in a number of patients, leading to their death if nothing is done about it.
So what's actually the primary route of transmission?
It's very much like HIV. It's blood-borne, bodily fluids. Can be transmitted sexually. It's not as readily transmitted as some other diseases, but probably more so than HIV. A lot of it was by transfusion. Mm-hmm. So it was only identified in 1979. The first test for it was 1981. Body piercings, reuse of needles, so the eastern parts, other parts of the world, there have been enormous infection rates by reusing needles during vaccination campaigns. In the U.S., there's still outbreaks of that source with medical instruments not being sufficiently cleaned. There's an interesting, there's other strange things that happen. I was involved in some work on hepatitis B. There's a cohort discovered in London where people were doing something called autohemotherapy. So they would take somebody's blood out, dilute it in saline, and then re-inject it. Don't ask me why. They were using 5-liter bottles of saline and managed to contaminate one from hepatitis C in such a clinic and then had an outbreak of about 80 people in the U.S. There's been medical instruments recently that both dentists and colonoscopies are perfectly clean. But it's mainly needle sharing by drug users in the U.S. People who had surgery before this thing was identified. Anyway, somehow that's led to about 4 million people being infected in the U.S. In general, it's something like 2% of the population in Europe and the U.S., 20% in Egypt and some other hotspots. It can be treated. So this is a chronic viral illness that you can actually treat and cure. It's a way of curing liver cancer or preventing liver cancer, which can treat people. But unfortunately, some people fail to respond to the best available therapies. Now that's changing. In fact, the virus is extraordinarily diverse given the high mutation rate. So globally, it's more diverse than HIV. And for reasons of that great diversity, there's no vaccine available, although the first vaccines are in trials.
So Alan, treatment means with things like you showed us in the first plot?
Yes.
Or?
Well, previous 15 years or so, it's been with interferon. I'll mention that in a second.
Okay.
And when you say that treatment can actually cure, so does it mean in terms of symptoms like cirrhosis and so forth, or does the treatment actually kind of get rid of the virus?
So the treatment gets rid of the virus. Until last year or so, it used to be called sustained virological response, which meant you treat somebody. And then at the end of treatment, you test to see if they have any virus. Assuming they don't, you then continue to follow them for another 6 months. And if they still were PCR negative at 6 months, they were said to have a sustained virological response. Now, people are starting to go back even 12 weeks, which seems to also correlate with not seeing the virus again. And the FDA last year said people can start calling that cure. But you're right, it does not necessarily lead to the full change in the liver. So this is a picture of a healthy liver versus cirrhotic liver. And there is some improvement, but you don't get full reversibility. You don't get rid of the virus. So what's happening?
Why does it sometimes take 30 years to manifest?
Mm-hmm. Well, so this virus is not cytolytic. So unlike HIV or influenza, it doesn't generally kill the cells that it infects. But it is recognized as an infected cell by the immune system, and it's under immune attack. And that immune attack leads to co-immunopathology, inflammation, and the way the liver responds in some patients is by wound healing type of responses. So there is death of infected cells, and it's not always replaced by healthy cells, but ultimately there's a fibrosis goes on. And if one looks microscopically, what one sees in cirrhosis, a large amount of collagen fibers that end up replacing healthy tissue and actually impairing blood flow to various regions. Also making it more difficult for drugs to get into it, leads to increased blood pressure. Increased blood pressure can affect the kidney and other organs. But this process responding in this way can be very, very slow, or is very, very slow in most people. There are things called fulminant hepatitis where people will get into this stage or even worse in a matter of about 2 or 3 years. But the typical time course is more like 30 to 40 years. And it's not fully understood at all, the biochemistry involved in this response. And that's a big area of research right now. Nor is it known exactly why it increases your chance of developing hepatocellular carcinoma. The virus doesn't integrate. as they say, hepatitis B does cause aggravated liver cancer, but that at least integrates into the genome of the argument. So here, it's really possibly the increased proliferation of cells as they're being destroyed. It's sort of very big. So in terms of treatment, so prior to May 2011, the two drugs that have been used were type 1 interferon in the United States, interferon alpha and interferon beta. They naturally made cytokines and are involved in protection against viral infections. Interferon was spawned because this was a compound found in blood that could interfere with viral infections. And it's not specific, it's a host factor. And it's been tried to treat a variety of viral infections. And originally, interferon alpha was first put into hepatitis C infected patients about 15 years ago. It led to, after 1 year of therapy, it led to cure of about 10% of people. And then another antiviral compound called ribavirin, which was made to treat respiratory syncytial virus. It's a nucleoside analog of guanosine. It works well for respiratory syncytial virus. If somebody decided to try it along with interferon in treating HCV infected patients, and that led to an increase in cure rate up to about 30% after 1 year of combined therapy. And then the problem with interferon is that it was injected, it's a protein, so it has to be injected. Injections were 3 times a week, and patients didn't like injecting themselves 3 times a week for a year. So compliance was poor. The pharmaceutical companies came up with a long-acting form of interferon, something called pegylated interferon. So you're basically putting polyethylene glycol or components of antifreeze covalently attached to this, which prevents or slows the degradation. And that led to cure rates approaching 50% in the US and Europe. It depends on the genotype of the virus. We may not get into that. But interferon has terrible side effects. I'm told you feel like you're having flu-like symptoms being generated. So it's like having the flu for a year when you treat with this. Ribavirin can cause anemia. It gets phosphorylated intracellularly, and red blood cells don't have any way of pumping out the triphosphorylated form. And some people need to anemia. So this is not an ideal therapy.
Is it a terminating nucleoside?
Pardon?
Is it terminating?
No.
The terminating chain is just different.
So it's thought to be a mutagen because then it gets miscopied. And it's been shown to be act by lethal mutagenesis in polio, which is an RNA virus specific has been used for. And it's been controversial as that's its mechanism of action. We can talk about that offline. It's a very long story about that. In May 2011, this protease inhibitor, telaprevir, was approved by the FDA, and shortly after, another protease inhibitor called oseplavir, made by another company, and just this year, a third protease inhibitor. They were all approved to be used in combination with interferon plus ribavirin because of the rapid development of resistance when we use this monotherapy. I showed you that on the last slide. And lastly, there's one polymerase inhibitor that's approved by Gilead, so maybe Charlotte will tell us more about it. It's a fantastic drug. And there are many, many other drugs in trials, and the hope is to move to all oral combination therapy, as is done in HIV, and get rid of both interferon and ribavirin, which have side effects. Now, let me tell you what happens if you treat a patient. And I'll do the story with interferon because that's where it started, but you see very similar things when you treat with either these protease inhibitors or polymerase inhibitors. So this is an early experiment from 1998 where some colleagues treated patients with daily injections of interferon, so QD means it's given daily, just the standard interferon alpha. And what you can notice is if you do the first injection at time zero, at day one before the next injection, that viral levels would fall in a dose-dependent way up to somewhere between 1 and 2 logs. And these are means of aid patients, so there are some that are down below that. And then if you continue injections with interferon, that you see that this rapid decline, which we call first phase decline, is replaced by a slower and somewhat more variable second phase decline. I don't have variances on here, but there's a lot of interpatient variability in the second phase, much more so than in the first phase.
That looks familiar.
Looks very similar to what we saw in HIV.
Exactly.
Except the time scale is close to an order of magnitude shorter. So in HIV, you see the same two-phase decline, but the first phase lasts somewhere between a week and 2 weeks, and also you get between one and two order of magnitude declines, and it's followed by a more variable second phase. So exactly.
But yeah, it is different because the agent is different. So this is adjuvant.
Pardon?
This is adjuvant, so it acts on the immune system as opposed to actually being a direct inhibitor.
Well, we'll see. That's the current. That's the standard view. The interference in these modulators. I think it's doing other things. I'll tell you why in just a second.
There's the is this the 5, 10, 15 of those different doses?
Yes. Yes. So this means million international units. It's a biological assay.
So why is there the one you need the most?
It has to do with the fact that this patient population is heterogeneous. And this drug does not work nearly as well in African Americans in the U.S. This cohort in Chicago, and this 15 million unit cohort turned out to be mostly African Americans. And when this was done, that was not known to be an important cofactor. But if you adjust for that, then you see the true dose dependence. And there's a genetic basis for that. I don't want to go into that. So what I was interested in is why is there a biphasic decline and what can we learn about it? So I and a number of other people earlier had worked on HIV infection and came up with what we call a standard model of viral infection. And the idea is that you have virus particles, virions, that can interact with cells susceptible to infection, target cells, and that leads in sort of mass action type of models with some infection rate constant to the generation of infected cells. In the case of HCV, since it's a non-integrating virus, cytoplasmic in fact, all infected cells, if they become successfully infected or productively infected, and make new virus particles. I just showed you if we somehow can interfere with this cycle, that the body can clear virus quite rapidly. And we know that infected cells are under immune attack of some sort and therefore can be lost. Uninfected hepatocytes also turn over. The uninfected cells are thought to turn over extremely slowly in the liver. If one looks at various animal models and tries to understand the turnover of hepatocytes, the estimates are lifespan, their inner division times are somewhere between 6 months and a year. So under healthy circumstances, there's very short turnover of uninfected cells. But we do put that into the models nevertheless. Our hypothesis, unlike what Alex Siegel had suggested, was that interferon is not acting to interfere with infection, which is where its name comes from. And that's because this picture plus one other observation, which I didn't mention, and that is that if you measure the amount of free virus in somebody who's chronically infected in their blood on various time scales of days, weeks, or months, what we find is that the level is relatively constant. So the virus forms or generates some sort of quasi-steady state level, the virologists call it a set point, and so the host and the virus come into accommodation. What this implies, you can see by this model, is that if I have an agent that acts by interfering with infection, modulates, puts target cells into what we call an antiviral state, prevents them from being infected, interferes with the infection process, that the infected cells in the liver would still be producing virus and would still be being cleared by phagocytic processes. And so the first order, an agent that interferes with infection would do nothing to the viral levels. It would fall by orders of magnitude during the first day of therapy. So our hypothesis was that even though there's substantial evidence for interfering with infection, but to get the kinetics that we observe, it has to act on cells that are already infected and interfere with viral replication in these cells or the ability of infected cells to export virus particles.
Could it be killing infected cells through activating double-stranded RNA-dependent kinase and stuff like
that? So the other hypothesis, I should say, it is consistent. The observations are consistent with it killing infected cells. We're fairly certain it's not that because of the rapidity of kinetics. So if you take this model, I'll show you the equation in a minute, and say, can you explain the rapidity of the loss of observed virus? You can, but you need a turnover time, the average lifespan of infected cells of under 2 to 3 hours. That's just too rapid. Plus, the death of cells tends to lead to the release of liver enzymes. Things like ALT, AST, you don't see those elevations. So there's no evidence of very rapid death, but conceptually that would also work. There are sensors that do detect the double-stranded RNA. It does generate endogenous interferon response. So those things are being detected, but don't get the reason for death itself. So our hypothesis is that interferon is acting really as a direct antiviral, explaining this rapid kinetics, and influencing cells that are already infected. And so we encode that in a simple mathematical model. It'll get more complicated, but the idea is if we try to track the change of virus with time, we said that each infected cell can produce virus at some average rate, p, the production rate of virions per infected cell. Virus is cleared, and we assume it's first order, just given the decays for exponential linear on log scales. And we introduce the concept of the effectiveness of an antiviral agent in blocking the production of virus from infected cells. We call that quantity epsilon, between 0 and 1. So if epsilon is 1, you totally shut off viral production. Now, if I make the assumption that before therapy that the patient's in steady state in terms of the virus, so at time 0, which is when therapy begins, I assume that the rate of production is equal to the rate of clearance. And let me also assume that over a short period of time, say the first couple of days of therapy, we see that first phase, that the number of infected cells doesn't change, stays at its initial value. And that's because, as I said, we know uninfected cells live extraordinarily long times. So let me make the assumption that even though you're infected, that you're not going to travel too rapidly. So then I can take PI, replace it by CP0, leading to just a simple first order linear equation. This is the solution, and now you can ask, does this fit data? And I'll show you it does, and the interesting thing is then you can actually estimate these two parameters, how rapidly the virus is being cleared from circulation, and also how effective the drug is, and you can do that extremely rapidly in terms of the data.
Alan?
Yes?
So just to clarify, so there are basically two ways this can act, right? It can act on infection frequency or on the burst size.
Right.
In principle, the only way to tell them apart is by the kinetics.
Right. And as I said, if we're acting on infection frequency, then the only way you get these rapid declines, quote, kinetics, is to have the loss of the cells that are already infected rapidly, which is what happens in HIV. Because you have a tenfold difference in kinetics, instead of having to worry about the lifespan of cells of hours, it becomes days, so 2 hours, 24 hours. So here's data of two patients treated with one with 10 million units, the other 15 million units. There's a short delay, and that has to do with the fact that interferon is a natural cytokine. It has to bind interferon receptors and signals hundreds of genes. So the drug doesn't instantly do anything like a true antiviral. The models we put in a little bit of time delay, and then these are that formula that I showed you in best fit. Dotted green lines is a correction when you relax the assumption that the infected cells are constant. But just to show you that it fits data on two patients, and the facts, it fits data on hundreds of patients extraordinarily well.
You have not data. Any way of independently verifying your epsilon and your C? By a different method?
People have independently verified that this acts on already infected cells in cell culture systems. The actual value has not been validated independently. And C, no, I forgot. I will come back to talking about C. It's very, very interesting. So it is still a prediction. And the cell culture systems for this virus are not very good. You can't just take virus from a patient and grow it on a cell line. So what the theory said, when you interpret these curves, is that initially you're in steady state so that the virus production is equal to the clearance, introduce the drug, then interferes with viral production, and it falls exponentially at grade C according to this theory. It comes down and it will then establish a new lower steady state value at large times when the exponent goes away. And so it should reach a steady value where the viral load is now 1 minus epsilon of where it started. So that says if I have a tenfold decline, I want to get to 1/10 of my initial value, the epsilon is 0.9. If I go down 2 logs, I want epsilon to be 99.99. So it says by just looking at the kinetics, I can read off the predicted effectiveness of my drug by the log decline. So we now talk about the drug being a 2-log drug, which means it's 99% effective at shutting off viral production or viral replication in infected cells.
Why does it come to a new steady state?
Well, it has to do with the time scales, it doesn't really. But that's what this, if the number of infected cells is constant, it would go to a new steady state. But in reality, the number of infected cells doesn't stay constant. It's on a longer time scale. They actually do die, and I'll show you that in a moment. I'll show you the same data set on it. So what we were able to deduce from this is we could estimate the drug effectiveness in blocking production. We could estimate the clearance rate, interestingly, or fortunately, it's independent of the drug dose, which is what you'd expect if it's a physiological process clearing virus. And what we could then do is say at steady state, if we knew the clearance rate and know the amount of virus, just measure it B0 and multiply by the fluid volume, you can then get the production rate of viruses body-wide. It's aborted 10 of the 12 virus particles per day, and that's become important in generating mutations for drug resistance.
And this is, like HIV, this is the first time we knew this?
Yes, exactly. First time we knew any of this.
Especially the last columns.
Especially the last column.
For population genesis.
Or any of these columns, in fact.
Right.
I should also say at this time, what was used as therapy was 3 million units a day. Not every day, but 3 times a week. That gives you something more like 30 or 40% effectiveness, which is why people aren't, you think, why people aren't being cured with these early therapies.
Alan?
Yes.
And the reason why, basically, the clearance rates here are highest, I guess, for the 10, and you wonder,
the production clearance rate's the last one. Oh, this just has to do with the patient cohort, so what their initial viral load are.
Same cohort that you described.
Yeah, exactly, that same cohort. So this is cohort, except to multiply by the baseline viral loads. What's interesting in terms of drug development, is this inspired the first 2-day clinical trial to measure the effectiveness of the first protease inhibitor that was put into clinical trials. This drug had never made it out of the early trials because of cardiac toxicities. It's just interesting that theory was taken seriously and led to clinical development. So this was a drug was given for 42 days. You can see these very rapid first phase declines with these new agents, and then they take the drug away and it rebounds. But I'm just pointing out that it actually had some practical implications of being able to estimate effectiveness fairly quickly.
So this is a 3-log order drug.
That was a 3-log order. New drugs are better. Real direct acting antivirals are much better than
so in fact, you can shut down production completely. In the second phase of decay, it's just the dying.
That's right. That's right. So our hypothesis is that the second phase, that cells with reduced HCV RNA production, not totally shut down to 99.9%. So those cells are ultimately lost through death or cessation of viral production. We also think we may be able to cure this infection because it gives a cytoplasmic RNA infection. So if all the RNA degrades, the cells is cured, so you can also see death or cessation. And so the second phase decay slope, we reflects the rate of infected cell loss with these remaining virus production. I told you about SDR, sustained virological response, a cure, we think corresponds to the loss of all infected cells.
And it's presumably the case that because this is a virus that doesn't integrate into the genome, there are much smaller problems with latency.
There is no latency.
Right, unlikely.
Yes. Although there is some concern now of double-stranded forms being somewhat long-lived. No one's found anything true latency, it was definitely no aberration. So I showed you this equation under assuming I is constant for the number of infected cells. We use mass action, it's just virus times target cells. I generate infected cells, and then they are lost or die. There could be some target cells, so kinetics is just as new hepatocytes are coming from a source, they die, they become infected. You can also put replication in. But our analysis for 14 days is we said, well, let's assume that there's no, the target cells remain constant for 14 days. Again, they live extraordinarily long times under normal conditions. That linearizes this, you can solve it. There's two eigenvalues. The interesting thing is if the rate of clearance of the virus is much larger than the death rate, and I told you the clearance rate is, the half-life corresponding to it is a matter of hours, and you think the infected cells live a lot longer than that. I just showed you that assuming if they're constant, fits the data pretty well. Then it suggests that you'll have two eigenvalues. One is the clearance rate, and the other one is the death rate of the loss rate of infected cells modulated by the effectiveness. And the reason they're modulated by the effectiveness is if there are new infections going on, it slows down those decays. But the effectiveness is, as I showed you, even by interferon, which is a poor drug, can be as high as 95%. So this is second phase slope is very close to the loss rate of infected cells, as I said in our words. And this is the same two patients that I showed you earlier that you said, why does it go to steady state? And that's because I showed you the data up to there. And the green dotted lines are showing that there's a slight difference, but you can actually see that there is a second phase slope. One can then estimate the half-life of infected cells. It turns out that these differences are quite substantial if you look at the standard deviations. So there is a lot of variability among patients for that. I don't want to go through the whole history of this, but this theory has done well. It was developed in 1998. We've used it and other people used it to show all sorts of other data sets. And in 2010, a group from Roche looked at over 2,000 patients that were in the registration trial for their pegylated form of interferon and asked, could a model like this predict whether you would cure a patient or not in a year's worth of therapy by looking at the early kinetics? So basically, you just take taking this second phase and asking if I extrapolate it, will it go below one virus particle or per body wide fluid? Or it's a little fancier, if you use the model and pick the data to the model, then you can then ask things about the number of infected cells. And so they used the criteria of having less than one virus and less than one infected cell. And what was quite remarkable to me is that they had a positive predictive value, fitting the early kinetics where you observe the virus before it goes undetectable, of over 99%, and a negative predictive value of about 97%. So you can say, if they're not going to hit this cure boundary, maybe we should stop therapy. And that prediction was 97%. So it's these simple types of ideas are quite good. I should say they did put proliferation of the target cells in and kept the target cells varying, which are classic models we've worked on also. So we've had about 15 years of success with this, and everything looked like it was great. However, as Jeremy asked, unlike HIV, there were no cell culture systems, and confirming predicted parameter estimates was difficult. Now what I'll show you is how this theory started falling apart as we looked at direct-acting antivirals. So those are, they work phenomenologically, but you may not understand them. So what we call things like these polymerase inhibitors, protease inhibitors now, we just call direct-acting antivirals. So they're density small molecules that interact directly with various proteins in the virus. And the ones that we have available right now, protease inhibitors, which I spoke about, polymerase inhibitors, and also something called an NS5A inhibitor. NS5A is a non-structural protein that forms part of what's called a replication complex. It has nearly no enzymatic activity. And the reason protease inhibitors are important is, as in HIV, this messenger RNA encodes what we call a polyprotein. So the whole genome, the whole messenger RNA, is one open reading frame. So it translates the whole genome and then uses protease to cleave out both host and viral encoded proteases to cleave out all the proteins. So let me show you earlier data on telaprevir. Again, this is the first HCV protease inhibitor that made it to market. It was approved by the FDA. It's being treated. This is monotherapy data. So it's just early phase one, phase two. It's applied at time zero, so patients are quote in steady state. You give the drug, and you can see these nice two-phase declines which we saw with interferon. First phase, again, is of order 1 day, and then it goes into the slower second phase. And these are our fits of the model. There's two fits here. It's somewhat technical. One is called constant effectiveness, which is what I showed you. And we also have worried a little bit about the pharmacokinetics of the drug and saying the effectiveness can be time-dependent. It's not a very important at this point. But we've been able to fit data from 44 patients that were made available to us from Vertex, and this is the quality of the fits. Extraordinarily good. What we learned, if I summarize the parameters, you still get two-phase declines. But now what we saw is that the first phase, as Dan noted earlier, much more dramatic. So they're closer to three logs. But more interestingly, if you look at the slope of this decline, you see for interferon, our studies, and also this huge Roche study, came up with a mean value of clearance rate of close to 6 per day. For these 44 patients, this first phase decline is 12 per day, twice. Secondly, the second phase slopes, even though we only had limited data going out in 2.5 days, and that was because resistance becomes a problem in longer time periods and the virus starts rebounding. It was about fourfold more rapid than we had seen on average with interferon. So the average of those 2,000 patients for second phase was about 0.14 per day, and that's actually the average that we had reported on much smaller cohorts, even though it was a large standard deviation. Here, the second phase slopes were between 0.5 and 0.7 per day. I'll show you that in just a second. So if clearance is just phagocytic cells eating virus, it should be a physiological process, it shouldn't depend on the drug, and if the loss of infected cells is immune-mediated, immune attack, you're not using an immune modulator, direct antiviral, why would it be faster? And in fact, interferon is thought to be an immune modulator. So one might be argued just it should be the other way around. This acts not only as an antiviral, but also an immune modulator. Here are the second phase slopes for those 44 patients, just per day, not listed. And what we found is an interesting correlation with the degree of the first phase decline. So remember, a three-log decline is a 99.9% effective drug, and you can see a very strong correlation. So it says that how fast you decline in the second phase depends on how potent the drug is at blocking replication of the RNA. So our interpretation of this, although we don't have any theory yet that exactly comes up with this functional form, is that if you have a very potent inhibitor of replication in cell viral production, that that cell then can eliminate the RNA inside the cell, and there's endonucleases which degrade it, and therefore you may be curing cells in addition to having them under immune attack. And so the better you are at blocking replication, the more likely you are to have the endonucleases that are degrading the RNA outcompete the replication, usually the replication. So I think this is an indication that in addition to immune-mediated attack, that there can be cure. This other interesting thing.
Is it also interesting to look at the first slope across patients?
Yes. So the first slope, we believe, represents the clearance rate, and that's different. It didn't correlate with anything.
That's right.
Yeah, so it didn't correlate. But we'll come back. This problem is my first thought, so that's what I'm leading up to. Again, it shouldn't be a problem with this theory. We also, at the moment, don't have a good theory to suggest that it should be exactly that form, but it's useful to use that. So one thing that you can do with that is you can say these second phases are much more rapid. Could we shorten treatment time? Interferon, I told you, you treat for a year. So what we did is we made an in silico population of patients based on the kinetics of these 44 patients. So we have probability distributions of their initial viral loads, of their clearance rates, their probability distribution, for their second phase slopes. And so we just drew from made in silico patients, we ran a sample from those three distributions, initial viral load, the first phase decline, second phase, and also their effectiveness. Made 10,000 such patients and treated them, and asked what fraction of them will pass this pure boundary of, say, less than one virus as a function of time. What you can see is somewhere, if you treat them by 6 to 8 weeks, somewhere up here, in fact, at 7 weeks, we would predict that 95% of people should be cured if decays continue with this same rate at the second phase. What that really implies is that you're using some sort of combination therapy so that you don't generate resistance. And that, again, inspired some drug companies to try some very short-term trials. And there's just a recent trial using a combination of three drugs: protease inhibitor, polymerase inhibitor, and NS5A inhibitor. So there's three classes of drugs. It's called Synergy Trial. Results are just coming out right now, but they treated 20 people for 6 weeks with these three drug combinations in two different arms, and they were able to quote cure 38 out of 40 of those patients. So these predictions are not totally off the wall, but more importantly, they stimulated the attempts to try these very short-term trials. Yes, gotcha.
So the drug combinations were three drug-acting antivirals, or did
they have
actually?
These trials, three.
Okay, so no interferon, right?
No interferon, right. And there's other things about this we can talk about in private. So we continue to look at other compounds. Flopper here, as I said, was the first. Another compound that was extremely interesting was a compound made by Bristol Myers Squibb, which is the first NS5A inhibitor. So I said NS5A is a non-enzymatic target. It's discovered in big screen looking for non-enzymatic targets. Compound is now called Slatosphere. And what we discovered is that the clearance rate is greater than 20 per day. Let me just show you that. This was the first time an NS5A inhibitor was put into humans. It was reported in Nature, and this was the data that they presented. Drug was given at time zero, and if you look at 12 hours, it's right, you can see the declines at the higher doses were three logs. And if you compute what a three log decline means in 12 hours, when activism started at time zero, there's a little bit of delay that gives you a half-life of the virus of 45 minutes, or sees something greater than 20. We actually got the data from the company, and we actually fitted, you get C of order 22 to 23, depending on the model that you use. So we know that the virus could be cleared this rapidly, and it's doing it. So Jamie, you're absolutely correct. Those other estimates were invalidated, and I think they were wrong. The reason that I think they're wrong, is that if one looks at what happens in the life cycle of the virus comes in, it makes RNA, you get pools of RNA in the cytoplasm, that RNA gets encapsulated. Virus particles are pre-made within these infected cells, and they're released during the secretion pathways. And so if you have an agent that acts early, that blocks RNA replication, the liver is still full of cells in which RNA has already been replicated, and full of cells in which, in principle, there are prepackaged virus particles. So our hypothesis is that this NS5A inhibitor is acting late in the life cycle and preventing existing RNA to be encapsulated and made into virus particles, and or that the preformed virus particles don't come out. while earlier compounds like protease inhibitors and whatever the interferon is interfering with is acting early. So that would argue that our assumption that you give the drug and you instantly reduce the production rate may not be correct. That there will be cells that are continuing to produce virus, but theory doesn't take that into consideration. The earlier theory didn't take that into consideration, so we missed estimating the clearance rate because there's continuing production. So the model.
That would be similar to your epsilon delta second phase decay.
Right. So that's also. So there are much more complicated models of replication now.
So, I mean, if there was an animal model, you could actually directly measure clearance by doing things like injecting fluorescently labeled virions and stuff like that, right?
Correct. That's been done for HIV. The only animal model is chimpanzee. Normally, they're barred, at least from NIH-funded research, and all this based on that. But anyway, that sort of...
Yeah,
it's pretty convincing, but you're absolutely right.
I mean, I suppose you could, I mean, although other animals might not get infected, you
right,
could at least try and
ask
about
clearance. It's not been done. As far as I know, it's not been done, but you're absolutely right. That can be done, and for HIV, that has been done.
So this cure relies on the cell being able to clear the viral episome, right, the virus, the genetic material.
Genetic material, right, so all of these are PCR-based assays. So it's fairly complicated, but given the level of detail, we decided to come up with a very simple model. And I like simple models. So what we said is that cells, when they get infected, let's assume they get infected by one virus, and this squiggly line is meant to be the intracellular RNA. And that during, as a function of the length of time that they're infected, they replicate the RNA and then it builds up. So we're going to keep track of what happens in the cell from the time it's infected. And we make a very simple model for what goes on with HCV RNA. We say it's being produced at some rate alpha. It can get degraded at some rate mu, and that the RNA can then be assembled into virus, and the virus is secreted at some rate rho. And that drugs can act on all three processes. They can block the assembly secretion, they can block production, so reducing production rate alpha, or they can influence the degradation, presumably enhancing. Because we need to keep track of how much RNA is in each cell, it becomes an age-structured model where we keep track of the length of time an infected cell has been, length of time a cell has been infected, which we call A, its age, and we say the kinetics of RNA depend on the age of the infection, how long a cell has been infected, not the amount of time. In this simple model, I'll present right now, if you only use to understand these experiments, we say production is constant. That's not true. It's being generated off of templates, off of negative strands. And to get cure, in fact, you have to worry about the degradation of negative strands and the fact that this is not truly constant. But the data we had and that I want to explain is only data taken over the 2 days again, so very, very short term. We assume you start with the infection of one virus, and the total amount of virus is that produced from all the infected cells. You put in therapy, and then you ask, can you fit this to data? And the answer is yes. So there are only five patients who have long enough. This is only a single dose of this drug in that experiment. So there were five patients where the declines continued out to about 2 days. The pharmacokinetics, which we were able to fit. We also were able to fit our old data on interferon. And what we discovered is for this NS5A inhibitor, it was extremely efficient, or we predicted it was extremely efficient at blocking both replication at 99.3% and also secretion of virus at 99.8%. If you don't totally block secretion and inefficient blocking replication, what would happen is the RNA within the cell will continue to replicate and just build up in the cell, and then it would still start coming out. This isn't 100%, plus you might even kill the cells because it's having too much RNA. So the theory does predict both. For interferon, it predicts 98% effective at blocking replication, so it's very similar to our older estimates of 95 and 96. Say in Caucasian patients, we can get up to 98, which is what this was. And hardly any effect on secretion, and hardly any effect on enhancing degradation. So one can ask, is this right? So we did an in vitro experiment. Yes?
So going back to the previous slide, right? The model gets to be more complex, right? You effectively added another time scale and eigenvalue, et cetera, et cetera. But the data didn't seem to get
any more complicated.
That's right. Better, right?
Right. So data is always
part of more data. So do we have to worry about the stability of bits or multi exponentials and the sort of nasty things like this? Are you getting your.
I think we're getting the time scale.
Data sources to generate more data for you?
We can. I mean, not in this experiment. It is possible that we can. We've been successful in getting patient samples frequently every 2 hours in other experiments. I don't know. I'm not sure it's necessary here, but so what we're looking for is in vitro confirmation to some of these things. And this is going to come out again in the next half hour. I don't know if you're interested. So let me just tell you about this confirmation. So our prediction is that this drug is satisfied by the inhibitor. It works in two ways. It's blocking both replication and secretion of the virus particles in trauma. So here's an experiment. It's on a cell line. Special class of viruses that grow on the cell lines. I'm comparing an experimental polymerase inhibitor, which is shown in blue, with this BMS drug in gray. Now, what the experiment shows is that if you titrate the concentrations appropriately, that the amount of intracellular RNA goes down with roughly the same kinetics. You're interfering with its replication, and there is degradation of the amount of intracellular RNA. And also loss of some RNA, obviously, generation of virus particles and secretion. Those are about the same. Now, if you look extracellularly at what goes on in the supernatant, and here they're extracting the supernatant and doing an infectivity assay, they're basically doing a plaque assay. They measure. They call them focus forming units rather than plaques, but they're essentially the same thing. What you see with the polymerase inhibitor, there is not much effect compared to mock controls until 8 hours, and you start seeing decay. And the extracellular decay roughly mimics goes on intracellularly. So you have less intracellular virus, the RNA, so you have less extracellular. If you look at what happens with the BMS drug, at 6 hours, when there's no change at all in what's going on intracellularly, maybe even a slight increase, is what we would predict if you're blocking secretion. Isn't statistically significant, we see a one log decay now of the extracellular infectious virus, and then it continues to go down much more substantially, suggesting that we are doing something to interfere with the production of extracellular virus. This is now being confirmed by another group, Tanlon's group, who's doing a totally different virus, totally different system. We fit the top of your data with this modeling, and I'll show this to you, but we also predicted that the protease inhibitors, particularly top of your, had an effect on extracellular secretion, and this other group, Stanlin's group, has now also confirmed that in the cell culture system. So we're seeing some agreement, at least qualitatively, between these models and being able to identify functions of various compounds.
Did you also check cell death in the system?
Yes.
So it's flatlined.
Yes. Over these time scales, it's not much cell death. Yes. Yeah, viability is checked. Okay, so let me just mention a few other things. One, I was having some discussions with Oscar, and the current issue of ours is our spatial models. I'm not really going to say much about it, but all the models to date have ignored the spatial structure. And we know the virus can spread cell to cell, and that's been ignored. I think it's important. And we know that, at least from in vitro experiments, so here is just a cute one, where you can take a population of cells and in suspension, try to infect them to get infection kinetics, and then one can add a monoclonal antibody that blocks the ability of the virus to infect cells and binds to the receptors that the virus uses. And type of antibody used was shown to block about 97% of the infection in suspension. But if the cells were allowed to form a monolayer, the same antibody now can block only 50% of infection over the same period of time, suggesting that the cells can be infected cell to cell. But one can also show it's a genetic trait. People identify mutations that enhance the ability of the cells to increase this number or decrease this number. So get more cell to cell infection.
Genetics and the virus.
Pardon me?
Genetics and
the
virus.
The virus. So we think that occurs. We are involved in a collaboration with a group at Johns Hopkins that takes biopsies of livers and can use lasers to take a biopsy sample and cut out areas roughly the size of single cells. It's called single cell laser capture microdissection. You can capture the cells that are cut out and then do PCR and measure the amount of virus. So this is just a color coding of how much virus there are. The ones that are white or uninfected, infected. Recently published a collaborative paper showing that the infection seems to be clustered. So again, the colors here have to do with the level of infection. It looks like the infection is patchy, not every cell is infected. And one of the interesting features is to try and explain infection models of this sort. So ongoing, yes.
Within a subject, are those different time points or are those different spatial locations?
The spatial location. So this is one biopsy, which is done by sticking a needle into somebody's liver, take the core from the needle, and they section it in different places. And this is just three different sections. And our suggestion was to do these grids rather than long tracks to try to detect clusters. And we can use clustering algorithms for edge effects and try to make some estimates of cluster sizes, etc. But this is just a two-dimensional section.
That are miles apart compared to the scale of the grid.
Oh, these things, yes, they're miles apart. Although one, so yeah, you can get adjoining sections to each other, do something, but you don't really know what the plane of the section is versus the geometry. So even if you have adjoining sections, topology is complicated. So every cell in the liver is in contact with blood, so the blood vessels that are intervening in things, which are in spaces that are sort of the size of the cells. So anyway, this is something people are interested in. We could talk about some analysis of this, but I don't want to pursue that. But let's go on to drug resistance. So I showed you this. So we'd like to explain that. So first, we think that there's a huge amount of standing variation. And the reason for that is I told you that we expect, of order 10 to the 12 virus particles produced per day. Now with these faster clearance rates, which went up an extra factor of 4 or so, this number is, on average has gone up to maybe 5 times 10 to the 12. It took a little over 40 past the clearance rate at steady state. We've estimated mutation rate subsequent to this, as I said, about 2.5 times 10 to the minus 5, so even a little bit larger than this. So let's just go with these numbers because they're easy. You can just do a Poisson or binomial distribution to ask how many viruses out of these 10 to the 12 are produced every day that have no changes, 1 day's change, 2 days changes, 3 days changes, Poisson. And with this 10% error rate, 10 to the minus 5th times the genome of 1,000, you get 9% of the bases would have 9% chance of having one base wrong, 0.5% of 2, et cetera. But you take your 9%, multiply it by your 10 to the 12 viruses, and that's the expected number of virus particles produced every day, or genomes produced every day, that you have a single mutation.
So that's a typo in the actual number for 3, right?
Pardon me?
The number for 3 is for 2.
That should be right. 8, right? It should be anything. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. How many infected cells?
We're not saying how many infected cells here, we're just saying how many genomes are being produced per day, because every RNA that's made is made by the action of this aerotrophic polymerase. Yeah. We think that there's, if you look at these pictures, it suggests somewhere between 10 and 40% of the cells in the liver are infected. Liver has about 2 times 10 to the 11th hepatocytes in it, so the number of infected cells is order 10 to the 10th of our best estimates.
So that means that the viral burst is about 10 to 2?
Pardon?
The viral burst.
It's an order 10 or something.
Per day, because these cells are constantly infected. Right. In fact, they can produce a lot of virus.
This is per day. And in the snapshots, look at the PCR distribution, the intracellular RNA, yeah, it's just snapshots. It seems to go between about the lower limit of detection with one copy to a maximum of about 50 RNAs per cell.
Well, that's why these cells survive. So the virus burst is actually quite small.
Yes, at least the virus production is very low. But anyway, there's only 30,000 single point mutations you can make, so you're making every one of those 3 million times a day, so 100% coverage. You do the same thing with the doubles. You have about tenfold coverage, you're making more than every double mutant 10 times a day. It's only when you go to triple mutants that you get a small number. So again, we think, as in the case of HIV, any viable single point mutation should exist. And most viable double mutations probably pre-exist at low levels. And when we do theory, we usually put things in mutation selection balance because of that.
So it's a little bit different than HIV because HIV...
The mutations occur during cell infection.
Right, so there's only one mutation that occurs per infected cell.
That's right.
But here you can have, in fact...
Every virus is being produced and in principle have a mutation. Exactly, so it's not coming off of a genomic template. These are the host viruses, which is why we think that the variation for HCV is bigger than for HIV. So what Alex is saying is if an HIV infected cell makes 10,000 virus particles, they're being read off of one provirus. If they use the host polymerases, which have error rates more like 10 minus 8, they're so base copied. So most likely all identical. So took our basic viral dynamic model. It's important to allow the target cells to proliferate. I mentioned that's one innovation we did longer times. And we just separated the populations into drug susceptible and drug resistant. And as we said, that every time a virus is produced, there's a possibility of mutations. So susceptible ones are producing resistant virus, and cells infected with resistant virus can have back mutations producing susceptible ones. And then we say that the drug has a certain effectiveness to the drug susceptible viruses and a different effectiveness against the resistant viruses. And everything else is pretty much the same. In that data set from Vertex, I told you that at day two, between 5% and 20% of the virus was resistant. And again, if we look at our model and say over the first 2 days that the target cells aren't changing, everything can be looked at analytically. And we looked at two different variants that do show up in those screens. One is 36 mutation, the other one 56. In vitro, their fold mutations, the fold resistance have been measured, which means how much you have to increase the concentration of the drug to generate susceptibility. And what our model predicts is that because the drug is so good against the wild type, that what you get these high ratios of resistant to total virus, not because the resistant virus is growing at these short times and taking over the population, but basically we're just uncovering the pre-existing standard of variation. And the interesting thing is these models with target cells constant only allow for monotonic decay. Again, the fold resistance also affects their fitness, and so we think it'd be level. So this is consistent with the observation that 5% to 20% of the virus is identified as resistant to day two. So nothing very surprising other than we think it's consistent with our ideas that the singles and doubles pre-exist.
But you don't see the resistance in the day zero sample because you only look at the sequence, right?
Exactly. If you do more sequencing or deep sequencing, you find enormous amounts of polymorphism in the protease. So here's the model with a T-variant where what we did is we took all the resistant variants and just lumped them together into one population because there wasn't enough data for anyone. And you can actually fit it quite well and predict what goes on in terms of various populations. We get these rebounds just as observed. Here's just a summary. There are these four patients that we fit. The drug we predicted is three log drug, so its effectiveness was 99.8%. In terms of the resistant virus, it's doing basically nothing according to our calculations, so 1% effective, not surprising. But the thing that is important is to drive all of this, we need a very high level of cell loss again, 0.44 per day. So again, a very high sort of second phase loss. And in this model where we put proliferation in, it's a logistic type of growth, where we're saying what's going on is the liver's trying to maintain its size by using proliferation to counterbalance loss. And so in this model, this loss meant, you know, true loss of cells. So it corresponded to having fairly high proliferation. So we have to replace cells at about half-life, doubling time of every 2 days or so. And it also leads to an increase in the total hepatocyte mass, because the infected cells are dying more rapidly than the uninfected cells, and so if you let the uninfected ones proliferate. So although it fits the data, we're concerned that it may not be realistic, that it requires too rapid proliferation, maybe too much of an increase in total liver mass, et cetera.
Can you remind me, is the delta the death rate of infected cells,
yes,
or uninfected, or both?
Just infected. Infected. Uninfected cells, there is a death rate, but it's extremely small. It's usually about 0.01 or so, given 100 day death.
Okay. And the reason for the elevated death rate in the infected cells is due to the immune response?
That's originally. Exactly. And you do need these rapid turnovers to explain the resistance data, and also explain the spatial pattern as to why, well, at least that's one possible explanation as to why the virus just doesn't spread everywhere and take over.
But that death rate would be high before the treatment. High death rate is not induced by the treatment, right?
So it's also
suggests that in infected patients, there's a very high turnover rate in the liver.
The clinicians I've spoken to, and sort of experimental neurologists, think it's high in general. But when they look at biopsy samples, you can look at fractional label mitoses and looking at the morphology, it doesn't look like so that many cells are in the cycle that rapidly. But again, it's very touchy feely. So we've been thinking about this, and we think that there could be about five different processes that could be important. Proliferation being one. The idea is, and I think this is the key thing that's not known about drug resistance in this field, is it's what Jesse Sommer, who studies hepatitis B, has called replication space. Basically, where does this resistant virus replicate? And the concern is that in a chronically infected patient, before you start treating with drugs, there's, you know, a lot of virus floating around. Every cell's in contact with blood, the virus is bloodborne. So my feeling is that every cell that can be infected probably is infected. Now, not all cells may be susceptible to infection because of interferon and other host defenses, but if they are susceptible, they can be. So now, resistant virus is generated or being selected for in standard variation. How does it grow up so rapidly? So one, in this model, was loss of infected cells and the replacement by new target cells generated by rapid proliferation. So I showed you that works.
Some fraction of which are susceptible.
Some fraction of those. Well, we assume all of them. All target cells are susceptible.
But you just said that the target cell that can be infected is infected at steady state.
Right. So that's one of the problems, right? Take into consideration. So the other thing is it could be a cure of infected cells, opening them up for reinfection. Cure them and then possibly reinfect them. I said no from immunology that interferon does induce antiviral states and prevent cells from successfully being infected. But that's being triggered by the presence of the virus in cells. As Andrew suggested, it has to do with detection of double-stranded RNA. And as the virus disappears rapidly, so don't forget these drugs like telaprevir, you lose 3 logs of drug in the first day. So maybe you release you stop the interferon response as the virus starts disappearing. And that would then open up a large fraction of the liver for the infection. It could be, you know, super infections, lots of infected cells. In cell culture, what's been shown is that if you take a culture system and put in 2 different colored viruses at time zero, you can get superinfection. Both viruses can enter, so more than one virus can actually enter and infect the cell. However, if you infect the cell with one virus and then wait a day, and then put in a second virus, the second virus will not replicate. So the first one takes over the host resources, establishes infection, and superinfection is not successful. However, what's not known, is whether or not I take a cell where replication has gone on with some drug susceptible virus, and I treat it with drug, well, so then becomes susceptible to super infection. And I've gotten a molecular virology lab at Rockefeller to do the experiments for me and Charlie Rice's group. And at least with some engineered viruses in the cell line and some drugs, we are able to treat them with drugs and allow super infection. It's still preliminary, not yet, and experiments are underway. So that is a possibility. And then there's the idea of intracellular competition, because a resistant virus is going to arise within a cell infected by wild type. You'll have both types of genomes in the cell. And then by intracellular competition, a resistant virus in principle could take over. And that's something my colleague Albert Onion has been very akin to. But you have the same issues, or some issues, of a cell that has resistant genomes in it, making proteins that are resistant, to what extent can we be shared? That'll also replicate wild type viruses. It gets very, very messy. And those experiments have not been done yet to show whether or not you can get successful full takeover of the cell.
Can you have
any of these are possible, not all of these are possible.
Can you have recombination?
Recombination is not observed. It's extraordinarily rare. So there's nothing like reverse transcriptase that's jumping back and forth. And also the replication, for this virus, as well as a number of other viruses, replication occurs in membrane-bound systems. In fact, it's thought to occur in vesicles. So the virus induces generation of intracellular membrane, that's been called the membranous web, or the vesicular membranous structures, like in alpha viruses. People believe that these vesicles are places where most of the replication occurs and protects the virus RNA from intracellular nucleases. So that also inhibit the transport and copying between compartments. So just to show, with models, we can ask if you were in an antiviral state and then start allowing cells that are not no longer infectable to become infected. We can fit the data again here. I think it's more realistic. It takes a day for the virus to come down, then we open up the cells that were, we put a model in our logistic. We said part of the liver was not infectable, and then we let it become infectable, and it fixed data, so not surprising. This is the last thing I want to show you. This has data that I don't understand. I'll show you a little bit, but some of the people here who like doing phylogenetics and other things on resistance, they find this interesting. Yes?
Can you go back
one slide?
Sure.
But we've done a hell of a lot of time. I don't know how much time do you need to.
Yeah, I think 15 minutes I can show you this last part.
So, you're basically saying that the resistance strain is an initial strain of balance.
To start.
Yeah. So, can you actually estimate the cost of resistance based on that? How do you get
it? So this is based on in vitro experiments. These things actually are measured in decomposition experiments, and we can measure the fitness of the virus. So those have been estimated for these strains by the company. In general, we can't do that. And the exact correspondence between in vitro and in vivo numbers, of course, is the kind of question.
Well, if you did deep sequencing at day zero, you can see the frequency.
So you can see the frequency.
That's a pretty existing resistant mutant.
Makes sense to go from there.
I assume you don't have this to interferon.
Pardon?
I assume you don't have resistance.
You don't have resistance to interferon. No one's been able to discover that. And that's because it turns on over 100 genes, and it's a host factor, and the virus is not there.